Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the Indonesian court has just made way for the country's new president to take office. What does this mean for the world's third largest democracy and the world's largest Muslim country? Then, a look at the deep structural and cultural disparities that laid the groundwork for the events in Ferguson, Missouri. Last Thursday, Indonesia's constitutional court ruled against charges that Indonesia's presidential election had been tainted by fraud, making way for Jakarta Governor Joko Widodo to become the country's new president. The challenge had been put forward by the former general of Indonesia's special forces, Prabowo Subianto. What does this mean for Indonesia? With us is Chris Wilson. He is a lecturer from the University of Auckland in New Zealand and the author of Ethno-Religious Violence in Indonesia, From Soil to God. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Chris Wilson. It's great to have you here with us.
It's nice to be here.
Let's start with the historic context about why this court decision and the election were really important for Indonesia and for the international community.
It was a really important election for a number of reasons. Indonesia's a consolidated democracy now. It's considered the only free democracy in Southeast Asia, which is pretty amazing given 15 years ago it was one of the most authoritarian under President Suharto. Incredible progress over the past 10 years, but there was still a number of concerns. Many Indonesians probably dissatisfied with what democracy was actually delivering to them in terms of development, progress. Wealth was being very concentrated in Indonesia, a lot of corruption, poor performance on the part of local and national government officials. Anybody who's lived in Indonesia often would hear from people that they missed that stability and that decisiveness of the authoritarian era. And so it was always a little bit unclear if they were given the choice of being able to, you know, roll back some of these reforms, whether people would support it. So in this election, the choice was very stark. It was very much a member of the old guard, a former general, the former son-in-law of President Suharto, even, who was in history of quite serious human rights abuses. And then on the other side, his opponent is a much younger man, 53 years of age. His name's Joko Widodo, known as Jokowi. But he very much came from nothing. Sort of, I've written that almost epitomizes the Indonesian dream, to use an American term. But he came from nowhere, grew up in the slums on the side of a river, worked in his uncle's furniture shop, then became a successful businessman in his own right, and then went into local politics and was elected mayor. While he was mayor, he has a very humble demeanour, wears modest clothes, he likes Metallica and heavy metal, people love him. He's somebody who actually talks to people and actually listens to them, and he seems like one of them. Indonesians see themselves in him. So he was very popular, and his policies were very popular as well, very much focused on the disadvantaged, social services, health, education, very much for the underprivileged in Solo.
And the disadvantaged is a huge number of the population, isn't it?
Yeah, Indonesia, despite very impressive economic growth, at least since about 2005, it's had an average of, say, 5% growth. So it's been doing pretty well, comparatively, particularly. But wealth has been very concentrated, and so the numbers of people living on $2 a day are still very large, probably 50% of the Indonesian population. Compared to its neighbours, Malaysia, Singapore in particular, Thailand even, other countries in the region, the number of poor in Indonesia is still very high.
Now, the transition to democracy, was that smooth in Indonesia?
It wasn't smooth. Suharto hung on for quite a while, wasn't managing the Asian financial crisis very well at all, and his normal supporters, the pillars of the regime, started to move away from him, the military and also many people within the political elite. And now that is because his patronage and corruption had started to become more and more centralised around his own family, in fact. And so many people were no longer supporting him and then moved away from him, and there were large protests. He resigned in the face of this mismanagement of the crisis and these protests, and then from there things moved very rapidly. A year later you had free and fair elections.
We've had how many elections?
So there was election in 1999, and there was an interim president who was Suharto's deputy. He lost that election. And then there was another one in 2004, another one in 2009, and now this one in 2014. So four elections, but they have changed in character as well.
How so?
The first one was very much parliamentary election, and then the parliament would choose the president. From 2004 on, there's been a direct election of presidents, actually executives at all levels. It's become far more participatory, if you like. Direct election of the president, there's election of parliaments, so local and national parliaments. based on electoral districts across the nation. But then there's a second election for the president, which is direct popular election. And so that is considered obviously to be a little bit more participatory. It undermines the possibility for money politics, they call it in Indonesia, corruption, vote buying and so on. But it also stimulates quite high turnout in Indonesia and is considered to be more democratic in that sense. And that seems to have been very successful.
So in terms of this particular election compared to the past ones, was it markedly different in terms of these types of, you said, vote buying and those kinds of activities?
I don't think there's probably that much difference. You have international election monitors. So they've all been adjudged clean, free and fair and peaceful. There hasn't been any violence. But in previous elections, the candidates have almost always come from the Suharto era, the authoritarian era. They've had past histories, you know, deep within that authoritarian era. Former generals, political figures, very, very wealthy business people. And so this election was very different in terms of the choice that people had. So I would put it that it's the first reform era election, because one of the candidates was a person that came out of the reform era, reformasi they call it in Indonesia. So this person, Jokowi, really made his success in the reform era. So this was the first time that Indonesian people had that choice.
When you had described the election before in your talk, you talked about how they engaged some American
campaign strategists.
Strategists who also used some dirty tactics. How did those manifest themselves?
Well, it can't be said definitively that the dirty tactics were down to this campaign strategist from the US. Some observers have pointed out other campaigns that he's been involved in. Mexico is one country. I'm not sure about experience in his past in the US, but those similar tactics have been used. But it's not necessarily was completely down to him. But there certainly there was this character assassination, black campaigning, they call it, in Indonesia. Most of it doesn't come directly from the camp, but it's coming from people associated with Prabowo, his name is, the former general. So there was questioning on social media and other forums, questioning of Jokowi's religion, suggesting that he wasn't actually a Muslim, he's actually Christian, perhaps Chinese Indonesian, perhaps even born in Singapore.
So it sounds very reminiscent of tactics that we did here in the US as well.
Yeah, it does seem quite similar tactics, doesn't it? And it hasn't really been seen in Indonesia before that I can recall in previous elections like that.
That character assassination-like?
I don't recall that having occurred before, no.
Do you think that, given that the rest of government is still majority, the old regime, that the new president will be able to have the kind of impact that he hopes?
It's going to be difficult. He's going to face a number of challenges. He has been sponsored by a long-standing, large political party, PDIP. He wants to form a cabinet and form a government of technocrats, people who aren't political appointments. He doesn't want to do political deals. He wants people who have the experience and the expertise in that ministry. That's going to be difficult. I'm sure he will get a number of appointments along those lines, but many he is going to have to pay off some political debts. There are going to be some political appointments, which is going to undermine this goal. There's a number of other obstacles he's going to be facing. Financially, he's going to have to find money to implement some of the pro-poor policies that he wants to. The starting point really is that recently there's been a number of challenges against the democratic institutions, particularly the Corruption Eradication Commission and other institutions that have been getting quite a lot of pressure from what you could call conservative elements within Indonesian society. And the outgoing president hasn't been doing anything to prevent that. There's been popular protest about it and standing up for the Corruption Eradication Commission and so on, but the government hasn't been doing very much. At the very least, Jokowi, I predict, will be a president who will be standing up for those institutions, won't be wanting to see those weakened or rolled back.
And Prabowo, he issued a legal challenge saying that the election wasn't fair. Court made the decision, I believe it was on Thursday. What was the challenge and what did the court decide?
They immediately launched a challenge. So the election was on July 9th. The quick counts, they have a number of polls across the country, stated that Jokowi had won. Prabowo also announced that he'd won and then announced that he was pulling out of the election. Then he was forced to come back in because it was illegal to do so. And then his team announced that they were going to launch a legal challenge in the Constitutional Court. Their submission stated that there had been massive structural fraud, according to Prabowo, even worse than North Korean elections on North Korean scale. And that trial has taken about, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks. And the court has seen it right to the end. It's followed the process without throwing it out because they wanted to give Prabowo a fair hearing and they wanted to see it through to fruition through institutionalised channels. They needed to do that because if they had thrown the case out, then it would have played into a discourse of the election being taken away from Prabowo. The problem was that Prabowo's camp was claiming that there was massive fraud in every province, and the margin of the victory was 8.4 million votes. Jacobi had 8.4 million more votes than Prabowo. So there was had to be substantial evidence to be able to prove there was fraud on that scale, the theft of 8.4 million votes.
Which would be hard to prove.
But Prabowo's witnesses came in with only hearsay and very small pieces of evidence.
Is the court aligned with any particular political party?
No, not at all. No.
So they're selected independently? Are they elected?
They are political appointments, but it's not associated with any party. The other thing to keep in mind as well is in Indonesia, it's not like in the US or many other established democracies where you have very strong party identities, different ideologies, and party loyalty on the part of members. It's much more fluid in Indonesia. You can probably point to a bit of a cleavage between nationalistic and Islamic parties, but even that is quite fluid. And so you do have a number of politicians moving from one to another. Generally, you have what are called rainbow cabinets. The government is made up of almost every party in the parliament. You'll have one party that's not, and that forms an opposition. So it's not like where you have that very stable party structure as you do in other democracies. So there's not really that sense where you would have a court stacked with judges that might favour one party or the other.
Plus the margin was big enough.
It required some pretty strong evidence, and they went over, it wasn't forthcoming.
It sounded from your talk that there were some pretty outlandish tactics, too, during the campaign where he flew out on a helicopter. Some pretty flashy.
So his campaign was very, very well funded. He himself has a fortune of about $150 million US dollars.
Yeah.
Prabowo is himself a very wealthy man. His brother is one of Indonesia's wealthiest people. He also had some very heavy hitters behind him in his campaign. And the rallies in stadiums, he would fly in by helicopter, come out of the helicopter, then leap on a horse. He rides horses, he owns a ranch. It was all very manufactured. He would stand up on a stage and he spoke into an old nostalgic microphone that was very similar to former President Sukarno in the very early independence years would use. It's quite nostalgic and was obviously harking back to that. And he would rail against corruptors and the theft of public monies in Indonesia, even though some of the biggest corruptors were sitting behind him on the stage, and unnamed international forces that were seeking to prevent Indonesia becoming the power that it should be.
You said in your piece that this was really almost an election for or against democracy itself, partly because of what he stood for, Prabowo.
That's right. This is probably the most important difference, really, and why it was such an important election and made so many observers really quite concerned. Jokowi, on one side, was certainly, as I've said, came out of the reform era and is very much focused on the nuts and bolts of improving existing practices and existing bureaucratic processes, institutions, trying to make those effective. On the other hand, Prabowo, who came out of the authoritarian era, made it very clear that he disagreed with many of the democratic reforms of the past decade. In particular, direct elections, the direct election of officials like himself, like he was seeking to be elected. He believed that was a Western practice and it needed to be abolished. It wasn't suitable for Indonesian culture. So that needed to be wound back. The party manifesto also said that they wanted to return to the 1945 constitution. So the first independence constitution. But obviously that means going back to before all of the democratic amendments that have been made over the past 15 years. So the amendments in the constitution that talk about an independent judiciary, the protection of human rights, individual human rights, holding free and fair elections, two-term limits even for a president, which you start thinking about things like that, and you start thinking about the Suharto era where the president stayed in power for 30 years. So they were pretty concerning rhetoric, and it made a lot of people worried that if he'd got into power, then he would have made those changes. You know, obviously you had some people who would say you're overreacting, that's unlikely to happen, and it would have taken a pretty firm hand to be able to do it, because there is a parliament as well that would have resisted much of that. But subsequently, with the result and with Jokowi winning, his attitude and the way he's acted, his behaviour, has almost kind of reiterated or confirmed those concerns. The way he's acted to every democratic setback, he has tried to say that, you know, taking it to the court at least, I guess, which is at least going through institutionalised channels, but talking about hackers, Chinese hackers, and Chinese and US colluding to make sure that Jokowi won. I mean, very sort of anti-democratic rhetoric and response to his loss.
Now, there were some protesters, and they called out a lot of police that clashed with them on Thursday when the court came out with its decision. Who were the protesters?
They'll be supporters of Prabowo, but one thing to keep in mind is protests are quite easy to organise in Indonesia. A small monetary payment is often enough to get a large mob out, or even promises of food. Those protests, and large numbers of police, yes, are called out because there is a history of protests in Indonesia, and they will take precautions like that and have a show of force. But the size of the protests, I mean, it's quite small, really, in Indonesian standards, and hasn't been very serious. Polls have shown, surveys have shown since the election that vast majority of Indonesians and both Prabowo and Jokowi supporters believe that the election was fair. And also other surveys have shown that Prabowo supporters have moved away from him, you know, very rapid levels. So I think it's finished. And yeah, there's some protests, but I don't think they will amount to much.
A lot of people in the West have said Indonesia is really quite this model. It's really important because of its model of democracy and because it's a Muslim country. Do you think the West is right?
It's fair to say that it certainly disproves any contention that Islam and democracy can't coexist. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that it should be a model for countries in the Middle East, for example, because the situations are just too different. The difficulties and histories and other problems in the Middle East probably make it quite a different situation. But it certainly does show that Muslim communities, Muslim society can support, and support for democracy is very, very high in Indonesia.
And so where do you see it going from here?
I think democracy will continue to be consolidated. There'll be setbacks and there'll be problems and there'll be political deals and there'll be an opposition within the parliament. And it's by no means the perfect democracy, but I think Indonesians have elected a president who is going to work within existing democratic institutions and practices, improve them probably, and hopefully improve bureaucracy, because that is a major problem in Indonesia. It all depends on how well he goes, really. If he struggles to get legislation through the parliament, struggles to vote to find those resources that he needs to implement pro-poor policies and some of the, because he's made a lot of promises, he's made a lot, and he has been elected more than any other president on the back of claims that he is going to implement pro-poor policies. So there are very high expectations on him, and at the same time he's going to be facing some serious opposition from the Prabowo coalition within the parliament, even some within his own party, because he's an outsider to his own party. He was brought in really because of his incredible popularity. But having said that, I think firstly he's done a very good thing by making sure that Prabowo didn't get elected, because I think Prabowo would have undermined a number of democratic institutions, and he will certainly work within. But certainly I think he's done a service to Indonesia by making sure that Prabowo wasn't elected, and he will endeavour, he'll face some obstacles, but he will endeavour to not just work within existing democratic practices and institutions, but improve them, and hopefully improve the bureaucracy.
And hopefully improve the lot of the people who seem to be suffering quite a bit.
That's right. There's a number of ways to do that. If he can minimise corruption, reduce corruption somehow, that's going to increase the public funds available to the government. Also, reducing, there are various major subsidies on oil and fuel in Indonesia. It makes up about 20% of the budget. Every time a president has tried to do that, a government has tried to do that previously, there have been very major protests. But those fuel subsidies overwhelmingly benefit the middle class, members of which have motorcycles, cars, far more than lower classes, lower socioeconomic groups. So getting rid of those subsidies will provide the funding for these type of pro-poor policies on education, health.
Chris Wilson, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Chris Wilson, the lecturer from the University of Auckland in New Zealand and the author of Ethno-Religious Violence in Indonesia, From Soil to God. When we come back, a look at the entrenched disparities that underlay the events of Ferguson, Missouri. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
The Ferguson, Missouri police shooting of Michael Brown has brought to the surface pervasive racial disparities in the United States criminal justice system, its culture, and structures. Our next two scholars have studied the issues extensively. Dolores Jones Brown is a professor in the Department of Law, Police Science, and Criminal Justice Administration at City University of New York. She is the founding director of the John Jay College Center on Race, Crime, and Justice, and the author of the award-winning book, Race, Crime, and Punishment. She's also co-editor of The System in Black and White, exploring the connections between race, crime, and justice, and policing in minority communities. Clarissa Ryle Hayward also joins us. She is a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis. She is the author of How Americans Make Race, Stories, Institutions, Spaces, and co-editor of Justice in the American Metropolis. Welcome, Dolores Jones Brown and Clarissa Ryle Hayward. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with Clarissa Ryle Hayward. You've used this phrase, thick injustice, to describe American cities and suburbs. You've said this is hard to see, hard to change. Now, in some cases, like in Ferguson, the injustice seems pretty obvious. How do you see this thick injustice, particularly in light of what we're witnessing globally when we focus on this incident with Michael Brown?
In Ferguson, right. So that term, thick injustice, is one that I came up with together with a co-author, Todd Swanstrom. And what we were trying to capture is multiple dimensions or aspects of what's sometimes called systemic or structural injustice. In the Ferguson case, we'd be thinking specifically about structural racial injustice. And our idea, the reason we chose the word thick, is that we felt like it captured multiple aspects of what's going on. One is, as you said, these are forms of injustice that are very deep, for instance, that have very long historical roots. Also, that are relatively intractable. They're more difficult than some more blatant or obvious forms of injustice to change. And sometimes, although as you rightly note, not in the past week and a half, they are opaque in the sense that they are more difficult for people to see. So structural forms of injustice were existing in the St. Louis metropolitan area and in St. Louis before the events that erupted in Ferguson in the past week and a half occurred, but many people, especially racially privileged people, were unaware of them. And that's the sense in which we mean that they're very often difficult to see.
So the incident actually brought these things to light.
Absolutely, right. And I would clarify that some aspects of racial injustice were salient and not difficult to see for those subjected to it, but for people who are racially privileged in racially privileged parts of the metropolitan area, many aspects of racial injustice that we've been focusing on in the past 10 days, such as racial profiling, especially of young African American men, were invisible to people who lived in more racially privileged parts of our metro area.
Dolores Jones Brown, would you agree?
I do agree, and I'm very happy that the professor sort of clarified at the end that, you know, black communities have been very clear that these kinds of injustices were going on. And what I'm a little disturbed by is that with all the taping of various incidents across the country, that there are primarily white audiences and even some black audiences who are still trying to deny the existence of this thick injustice.
Now, the denial is rooted in what? Do you have a sense of why that occurs?
I've been working with a lot of social psychologists, and I think for many whites, they want to believe that America is the utopia of democracy that has been advertised since the beginning of the establishment of the country. And I think for many blacks, they do not want to accept that despite all of the years of struggle and despite us being about 100 years beyond emancipation, that we are essentially still in the same place that we were in terms of our status as equal citizens.
Now, Dolores Jones Brown, you also worked within the criminal justice system prior to entering academia. What are some of the other aspects that you saw from the inside out that you then studied as a scholar?
I worked in the Department of Corrections and in community-based corrections for a while, and it's always been clear to me that in terms of sentencing for the same kinds of offenses, people of color almost inevitably receive stiffer sentences. I was profoundly struck by my role as a prosecutor in a local county that the courtroom personnel in my county were predominantly white, and the people we were processing through the court system were predominantly black, and that when, on the few occasions when whites did come through the system, the colleagues who were white were far more empathetic and sympathetic to whatever their plight was than they were to the black defendants.
So now when we go back into how these develop, Clarissa Ryle Hayward, you've written quite a bit about identity, collective identity, institutions and narrative, and how these really become calcified, for lack of a better word. How would you describe this process so that we can understand it?
Yes, let me take a stab at that. The idea there is that many people who write on identity think about identity in terms of people's beliefs, in terms of people's attitudes, in terms of the kind of narratives we tell about who we are. I think that captures a piece of what identity is, but I also think an important part of how identities are kept alive is through institutional forms and through material forms like the urban and suburban spaces that make up our metropolises. So, for example, if you think about the racial identities that are what we're focusing on now, an example of institutions that are extremely relevant that I emphasize in my work are some of the New Deal housing policies that were developed over the course of in the middle decades of the 20th century, which disproportionately favored white Americans over African Americans. And essentially, the language that I would use is they, I think you said, solidified, or they helped to give an enduring power to racial beliefs that were dominant in that part of our history in the early 20th century. So just to give you a very concrete example, if you think about the FHA policies, they essentially gave state-backed mortgages at very favorable rates to white homebuyers. They were explicitly racially discriminatory policies. And if you think about Ferguson, this would have been one of the communities, people in the media have been referring to it as a white flight community, but one of the communities where homeownership was subsidized by the federal government, but specifically for white homebuyers. So I think that that's an example of an institution that helps to shape in certain ways racial identities and specifically inegalitarian racial identities.
Dolores Jones Brown, what would you add?
What has become most disturbing for me is that when I look at the cases of police fatalities, they have cut across all socioeconomic categories. And so this means that the racial identity that may be most predominant in white people's minds of blacks as poor and potentially criminal have actually been projected onto the cases I've studied, a Hollywood actor, police officers, graduate students in college, high school students, insurance salesmen. I want to say this also, both black males and females, because there's a conversation that takes place that says, you know, black males are most at risk for this kind of police encounter. But we've got a growing body of cases that involve black females. And I don't know if you guys have seen the footage of the California Highway Authority officer beating 51-year-old Marlene Pinnock on the side of I-10. The way in which that officer viciously attacks her says that females are also not protected from this kind of police activity. And so, again, what I find most disturbing is there is almost no identity you can have as a black person that will shield you from this kind of over-excessive police behavior.
Dolores Jones Brown, you've also written in a couple of articles about how the law is used as a tool that benefits some groups and oppresses others. Now, we see this, obviously, how it oppresses others. Can you talk a little bit about how it's a tool to benefit the other groups?
I think Professor Hayward actually did a really great job of summarizing some of the economic advantages that whites have been able to benefit from because of things like FHA loans. In employment, the notion that for a long time job discrimination based on race was permissible and sort of the standard means that whites ended up in positions that they then could pass on an opportunity to become employed to their siblings and later generations through the process of nepotism. And that was something that for blacks did not exist because blacks had been excluded, particularly from professional jobs. And so that's certainly one way in which the laws benefited whites as opposed to blacks. As a criminologist, I am always struck by what I call the abusive use of crime statistics, where we focus on the percentage of criminal offenders who are described as black, and then we make a comparison between that percentage to the small proportion of the American population that blacks make up, which is roughly 12 to 13%. And then we say, well, this is evidence that blacks are involved in most crime or they are more crime prone than whites. But that then means that a large number of white criminals can go into various places like a movie theater, a elementary school, a federal building, and wreak havoc. And they will only be seen as individual white offenders.
Right.
But when a black defendant engages in less atrocious behavior, that behavior is considered a mark against the entire race.
Clarissa Ryle Hayward.
Very often, a law can, on the face of it, seem as if it's race neutral, but it can have completely predictable racially inegalitarian effects. And one example I was thinking of is if you think about, for instance, the mortgage interest tax deduction, that disproportionately benefits people who have the most wealth because they can buy the largest houses with the biggest mortgages. To state it that way, it seems as if this is a race neutral, although a class biased policy or law. But in the U.S., whites have the most wealth for many reasons, including that we had a dual housing market in this country just until the late 1960s. So that's an example of a law that one might look at it and say, this is not a racially biased law. But not only is it racially biased, it's racially biased in entirely predictable ways and due to a long history of racial discrimination, including state-sponsored racial discrimination.
There was a period of time when people believed that we were making very serious progress, and then there was a period that followed it that seemed to exacerbate problems a little bit more. This probably occurred more during the Bush 1 administration, the Reagan administration, where they encouraged local schools and such to fight back against efforts to desegregate. And so now it seems we are facing an era of resegregation, or so I have read. Dolores Jones Brown, would you agree with that?
I certainly would agree with that. And what's sad, and I hate to admit it as a criminologist, that so much of what has been what I call the retrenchment of civil rights achievements has been associated with criminal justice. I think that the work in the 90s of John DiUlio from the University of Pennsylvania and this notion of the coming of the super predators painted black children as potential serious violent criminals. And I think that's part of the reason why we see communities developing resegregated schools, because families are wanting to get their kids away from these potentially dangerous black children.
If we wanted to turn towards solutions to then actually create, you know, what Americans would like to believe the country is, how do we go about doing that? Dolores Jones Brown, you've written a bit about this. You've talked about multicultural competence, particularly within law enforcement communities. How do you see this as a potential solution?
I think it becomes really important for people to recognize and accept, and in particular police officers and other people in positions of power, that difference is not necessarily bad. And I think there's a way in which we have allowed people to accept the notion that any person who's not heterosexual, white, mainstream, middle class, home-owning, church-going, is problematic. If they don't dress the same way that folks who fit in all of those categories would dress, if they don't wear their hair that way, they don't walk that way, they don't raise their families in that way, that there is something problematic with them. And once you add on the historical layer of race, that just exacerbates the situation more and more. And so what multicultural competence training helps police officers and others to understand and hopefully come to accept is that difference is not indicative of a negative trait.
So Clarissa Ryle Hayward, I'd like to turn to you and put this in the context of your big questions that you ask in your scholarship, which is about social power and how it shapes human freedom and how identity fits into this. So how can we contextualize what we're talking about into this idea of social power and human freedom?
Well, there are a lot of different ways to do that. I think if I were going to try to tie those ideas specifically to the issue we've been talking about, you pose this question of, you know, segregation and what looked like progress and then a decline during the latter part of the 20th century. I think that one of the very important mechanisms of power with respect to this question has to do with the way that we delegate authority to make certain kinds of political decisions. We've been having this conversation partly prompted by the discussion of what happened in the St. Louis metropolitan area last weekend. And St. Louis is famous or infamous for being one of the most politically fragmented metropolitan areas in the United States. So St. Louis metropolitan area alone has almost 400 local governments. Ferguson is one of those. And if you look at work that demographers do on residential segregation, you know, in the wake of fair housing laws, one of the strongest predictors of racial residential segregation is low-density zoning. So zoning laws that prohibit or very strongly limit multifamily housing would be an example, that require single-family houses, large lots, those sorts of things. If you have a very politically fragmented system of local governance and you devolve to individual municipalities the power to zone, you are going to have municipalities, like extremely wealthy municipalities in the St. Louis metropolitan area, that use this low-density zoning as a way to effectively limit access to the municipality and to the public services that it provides, to limit access to people who are lower income, lower SES. So in terms of change, I would say, you know, an example would be legislation or policies that require inclusionary zoning, that require housing developers who are going to build a new development to include a percentage of units in their development that are affordable units, that are multifamily housing units, that are going to accommodate people from a wide range of socioeconomic groups. So that's one concrete policy change that would help turn around some of this resegregation, was the word that you used. And so when I think about power, I think about it in multiple ways, but I think one particularly salient and important way to think about it is in terms of laws and policies and state-sanctioned forms of power, which can limit or enhance freedom.
And Dolores Jones Brown, let's go back to you. You've talked about culture and training. Are there other aspects of law enforcement structure, culture, and training that you think also need to be addressed?
I think that there is a way in which many large cities, and New York City being one of them, and from what I'm learning about sort of St. Louis and its suburbs, that the power that lies within the decision-making that police departments make creates this dynamic that allows Michael Brown killing to occur and have it then morph into the kind of protest movement that we see, which I think is very important because for so long in major cities, and I have to say I do work with some very progressive major cities where this is not the case, but the notion is that the police department makes a decision about how it's going to police the people. And in the more progressive cities, the police department engage with the community to say, first, what are the problems you see that we need to help you address? And the notion is that the police is providing a service as opposed to playing the role of an occupying army or playing the role as a means of containing and controlling the certain segment of the population so that the more affluent portion of the population can feel more safe, feel more at home, or as we see in many major cities, gentrify areas, force out the socioeconomically disadvantaged and people of color from locations where they've been for generations so that whites can move into those areas and enjoy, whether it's closeness to water, convenience to downtown and their jobs, but that if we don't work with police departments to convince them that the community has a say in how they're policed and that people who are poorer deserve to remain in various geographic areas. And I really appreciate all the comments that Professor Hayward made about the ways in which power and property and economic well-being becomes the driving force in what's important for Americans, but at the same time, blacks and other racial ethnic minorities are pushed out of those positions of power in those geographic locations.
You bring up this idea of the occupying army, and the reports are coming out that police are becoming increasingly militarized. Do you see that as well?
Yes, and it's an interesting notion that when we being Americans began to adopt the language of war to describe crime fighting or enforcement activities for police departments. So we had a war on poverty, we have a war on drugs, we have a war on terrorism, and all of these wars, of course, suggest that military-style equipment is necessary to bring disorder under control, to bring crime under control. And there's a way in which funding has been funneled into police departments to provide them with these artifacts of war to use against civilians. And I would say on a sort of exaggerated notion that urban crime and urban criminals were so fearless and so much to be feared that the police needed to have this military-styled weaponry to address that issue. And I think, again, this exaggeration occurs in part because of the longstanding historical association of racial and ethnic minorities with hypermasculinity, hyper-aggressiveness, hyper-criminality.
Anything you'd like to add on that, Clarissa Ryle Hayward?
I think those are terrific points. In my work, I've thought a lot about education, and I think there's kind of an overlap in a sense, because both the police, which is supposed to be a public service, it's supposed to be something that serves all or serves the community, as Professor Jones Browns was saying, and in, when we talk about education, we also talk about public education. And I think these points raise the question, who is the public? So that word has this connotation of inclusiveness, of something, whether it's protection or security or education, that's for everybody. And I think that when we have public services, if you think, for example, of public schools that essentially are not equally available to everybody or that work for the benefit of some but not others, as Dr. Jones Brown was saying with respect to the police in many urban neighborhoods, this is actually not a public service in the sense of one that is for the community as a whole. And I think our language of calling it public suggests that many of us believe it ought to be. So there's a real tension there between our stated ethical beliefs and our practices.
Clarissa Ryle Hayward and Dolores Jones Brown, thank you so much for sharing your research and your knowledge with us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Dolores Jones Brown is a professor in the Department of Law, Police Science, and Criminal Justice Administration at City University of New York. She is the author of the award-winning book, Race, Crime, and Punishment, and she's also co-editor of The System in Black and White, Exploring the Connections Between Race, Crime, and Justice. Clarissa Ryle Hayward is a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis. She is the author of How Americans Make Race, Stories, Institutions, Spaces. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We are joined by Garrett Albert Duncan, Professor of Education and Director of Program in African and African American Studies at Washington University of St. Louis. Duncan has published extensively on Black youth, identity, language, and the social, political, and moral foundations of U.S. public schools. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Garrett Albert Duncan. It's great to have you here with us.
It's my pleasure.
You have articulated some of the conversations that are going on around the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson as not really being rooted in ignorance or racial animus per se, when people do not understand the racial component of why this occurred. But you say they are rather rooted in another kind of American culture. What is that?
The American culture to which I speak, in fact, when I speak about not rooted in racial animus, I mean more or less very explicit racial animus. In other words, I don't believe the officer said, look, there's a black guy and I'm going to shoot him because he's black. But I believe people speak about institutional racism, but I'm speaking about what is called civilizational racism. It's rooted in our metaphors. You've heard Malcolm X and Martin Luther King talk about why is angel food cake white, why is devil's food cake black, a good lie is a white lie, a bad lie is a black lie, so on and so forth. So I'm going back to something deeply rooted that becomes part of our common sense and is no longer linked to its racial origins. And I'm talking about something that has been 500 years in the making.
A couple of things I've often thought about when I think about language and how we express racial differences, even using the words black and white, when that itself seems to create a dichotomy, whereas it seems like if we were to really acknowledge that skin color is a continuum, would we be able to understand race differently?
Well, I don't think so. Keep in mind, race literally refers to two things. It refers to separation, so it's much more than black and white, and you know, and there's a continuum, but it refers to both a separation and a hierarchy. And so that's where the problem comes in, with the hierarchy from superiority to inferiority. And just to be clear, there's always been hope. You know, there's been these pockets of resistance. For example, in the 1700s, you had people from Europe, Africa, and Asia, as well as here in the First Nation, where we weren't referred to so much by our skin colors, but by our ethnic groups. Like, instead of John the Black Man, it would be John the Evil. And so we were seen as individuals, like other people see themselves as individuals, but something went into the making, which is largely cultural, where those who were once individuals, they become representative of a group, or more or less a social group. So, yes, we could go back and speak in terms of the continuum, but truth be told, and I believe it will be a change in the vocabulary, and, you know, vocabularies change often, but grammars are far less forgiving, and so what you will find, you will still have the grammar of race and racism.
Another aspect of the culture that you have written about in something called The Conversation was really about property rights as a cultural value seen as more important than human rights, and that is part of what is underlying this as well.
Absolutely. In fact, I had this discussion earlier today with a group of first-year students. One of the things, in very concrete terms, we have to recognize that the foundational legal document that informs jurisprudence and even some of our common sense thinking in the United States is the Constitution. And the Constitution favors civil and political rights. But there is another document that is more generally addresses things more generally, and I'm talking about the United Nations Declaration of Universal Human Rights. And in the United States, we don't recognize those cultural, social, and economic rights of all folks, including children. So coming back to the United States, we see this historically, I mean, self-evident in the history of chattel slavery, where human beings were seen as property. But even nowadays, women, in terms of their worth, they're not viewed as valuable, and I use that word selectively, as men. Children are not viewed, and in fact, they're seen as commodities, where we talk about them as being our greatest resource, as though they have no intrinsic self-evident value in today. So it's deeply etched. But in the Ferguson situation, it just came out in bold relief. Everything was mobilized around protecting physical property. The arms did not come out to protect residents or other human beings. It was there solely to to protect property, and when the property was threatened, then you had the unleashing of the wanton violence upon the residents.
Another aspect that you've written considerably about is how the education system is connected to this inherent injustice. Mm-hmm. How do you connect those two?
Well, two things. First, I actually was on the campus of Normandy High School earlier this year, and that's the school where Michael Brown graduated. And I will tell you, the young people there are marvelous. And, you know, like I expected, that's been a part of my background teaching high school and middle school. So I want to put that out there because there's this notion about the students per se. But then on the other hand, and this is the problem that students and parents have less control over, that much of our educational system is outdated, is still based on a industrial world, a manufacturing world, where we've shifted in terms of our economy and, you know, our way of life to more of a service-oriented, high-tech world. And when you go to a number of these schools, the schools, if they have equipment that can begin to prepare them for this kind of world, the equipment is often dilapidated. I have video footage that will make you want to scream along those lines. And so what happens? You have students doing everything they were told to do, but when they come out, they are underskilled and they are vulnerable. First of all, it's very difficult for them to get gainful employment or to be successful in higher education. And they become vulnerable. It's almost as though we're creating a superfluous or a surplus population. And so the schools are undermining kids by the nature of them being outdated. The education being provided for our children is, for the most part, was fit for the early 1900s and 1950s, and that wasn't good for immigrant kids or for students of color because it prepared them to be second-class citizens, and we have that now.
And so how do we shift the education then? How do we update it so that we are not creating this permanent underclass?
Well, you have pockets of resistance everywhere, and let's be clear. We don't need prescriptions. We don't have to come up with anything magic. You have people all over the United States, whether it's West Philadelphia, Southern California, places here in St. Louis, and in New York. You have perfect role models where you have innovative leaders who have broken their wedding, you know, that are no longer wedded to these really old and outdated ideas. And I will tell you, a central feature in these different successful stories, and I write about those because it's my responsibility to at least offer something, not to make people groan and not want to get up in the morning, but, you know, we have to offer hope. And one of the central features is strong leadership, either at the principal's level, because the principal is on the ground, local, and 8 times out of 10 is usually a woman, and 6 times out of 10 is a woman of color, or someone who's willing to break the rules in the classroom, a teacher who's innovative, who teach the expected skill sets, but will do something else that is novel, that will place their students in a position to be competitive, to either compete with the rest of society, or to be entrepreneurial and to create something. And so we have this happening. These are not celebrated, but they have been written about and have been documented.
Can you give us one really good example?
You know, I was hoping that you would ask. I wish I was there with you so I could show you video and a PowerPoint. But my favorite example, in fact, can I give you 2 examples?
Please.
Okay. My favorite classroom example is what's happening in West Philadelphia, where you have this young teacher teaching kids in an auto repair class or whatever it is, automobile class, and these kids are producing these high-tech soybean-fueled cars. And they're competing with all the major corporations. When you see these cars, they look like Maseratis, Cadillac XLRs. First of all, they look good. So they're not looking like one of these bubbles you wouldn't be found dead in. They look good. They go from 0 to 60 in like 4.5 seconds. And their goal at the last that I was studying them was to get, let me see, I think they wanted to get their cars between 60 to 80 miles per gallon in their car. And these are soybean fuel, so they're green. And these are black and Latino kids who have been kicked out of school because they were considered to be uneducable. Is that amazing or what?
That's amazing.
Okay, the second example we have around the United States called these promise programs. Now, not all promise programs are as promising as the other ones, but the one in Kalamazoo, you had a special ed teacher who is now superintendent of schools. She went out to the local businesses, private donors, and she got them, and they're all anonymous, to create an endowment that every child that goes through the Kalamazoo public school system and graduates will have up to 6 years of college at any of their public institutions, from community colleges to the University of Michigan, and it'd be absolutely free. Everything is absolutely paid for. And so that means you could have a kid going through and getting a University of Michigan degree, I mean, just changing the quality of life. And what has happened, and this is probably what really touches my heart, was a little kid, it was a kindergartner, he's telling this person, "I'm going to college." And then he pauses, he said, "I don't know what it is, but I'm going." And so, you know, everybody was laughing. So you have this academic push, and you have this hopefulness among parents, because you have a number of first-generation students, potentially, whereas their parents have been sold false promises and disappointed and, you know, have been frustrated. And now it's just, can you imagine, it's like winning the lottery if you know that your child has a chance at a guaranteed education for free, when many of our kids are leaving college with a minimum, on average, of $75,000 in debt. Can you imagine being able to get a degree and without any debt and being able to move on with your life?
That's remarkable. Garrett Albert Duncan, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Oh, absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Garrett Albert Duncan is a professor of education and director of program in African and African American Studies at Washington University of St. Louis. Duncan has published extensively on Black youth, identity, language, and the social, political, and moral foundations of U.S. public schools.
That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper and Ankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.